It's 2026, a new calendar year, and that brings a lot of significant events. Europe has had some pretty big changes and new positions over the last week. It was also a much more subdued new year in Europe, with some celebrations cancelled over fears of terrorist attacks, and then a tragic new year for one of the celebrations that did go ahead in Switzerland. Iran is experiencing mass protests, with the government killing some of its own citizens and Donald Trump threatening to get involved to stop the violence. But meanwhile, Iran is looking at developing not just nuclear weapons, but biological weapons. Vladimir Putin says that Ukraine tried to murder him this week. Is that true? And do the statistics from 2025 show that Donald Trump's tariff plan is working? We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World. It was a pretty sober New Year's Day after 40 partiers were killed and about 100, more than 100, injured on New Year's Eve when a crowded bar caught fire in southwestern Switzerland. Many of those injured are in pretty serious condition. It doesn't look like it was any kind of terrorist attack. Instead, it started accidentally. Video footage shows champagne bottles with sparklers on them being held close to the ceiling, and then the ceiling caught fire, and very quickly the entire restaurant with about 200 people in it went up in flames. But the celebrations for New Year were already more subdued in a lot of major cities, not just in Europe but around the world. Bondi Beach's New Year's Eve event was cancelled, both due to maybe fears of attacks, but also due to the aftermath of the December 14th terrorist attack there and sensitivity to the victims of what happened. Paris, every year, they have a pretty big, well, a massive live concert on the Champs-Élysées. It's been going for about 60 years. You have about 1 million people turn out. This year, they cancelled it. It was replaced instead by a pre-recorded concert broadcasted on television that people could watch in the safety of their own home. Tokyo is a pretty famous New Year's Eve countdown. That was closed due to fears of overcrowding and crowd stampedes and other unspecified security fears. Chicago introduced a 10 p.m. curfew for all unaccompanied minors, and law enforcement issued a threat assessment saying that the city's fireworks celebration was, quote, an attractive target for both foreign terrorists and domestic extremists. This comes after Christmas markets all across Europe have also been much more subdued or have been taking place under greater security. I mean, before we move on from the New Year's celebration, I should note that places like London and New York, their celebrations did go ahead, but with a heavier police presence than we've ever seen before for those events. Going back to those Christmas markets, the Catholic Herald described the security of Germany's Christmas markets this year as the tightest seen in peacetime Europe. So, in a sense of fear beginning the new year, they're all different threats, or there's often cancelled for multiple reasons. Some of it is the fear of crowd stampeding and just panic and or narrow entrances. I mean, crowds can be a major danger in that way, but clearly fears of Islamist terrorist attacks are behind a lot of this as well. We're getting to the point where much-loved celebrations that a million people turn out to, the government's like, no, we can't do this kind of thing. It's a powerful symbol of the way that fears of terrorist attacks are starting to impact everyday life. And that's not to say that these celebrations are necessarily good things. You can go back, you could have a look at our segment that we did on Christmas and its roots on paganism a couple of weeks ago. My point is just that much-loved celebrations that millions of Europeans attend are getting cancelled due to terrorism and ultimately migration, importing a lot of, foreigners, but mixed in with there, some pretty evil people from the Middle East. And it's starting to impact things people love and do regularly. It brings to mind some pretty specific prophecies. You go to Leviticus 26, and that talks about the blessings and cursings that God promises to Israel. And he says, I will appoint over you terror. And he says, you shall flee when none pursues you. You're going to be canceling events, even and running away and staying at home and staying safe, even if there isn't actually a threat there. Just in case, because you're surrounded by terror and attacks. We're just in the earliest days there. And Leviticus chapter 26, this applies to modern Israel. The Bible is full of prophecies about Israel. If you believe the Bible, you have to believe that there are some tribes of Israel out there. It has all of these prophecies, and so many of them could not be fulfilled in just the Jews in the Middle East. You know, it gets very specific with numbers, with there being thousands of millions of descendants and massive, powerful nations occupying sea gates and important trade routes all around the world. Well, where are they? Are those prophecies correct? Is the Bible correct? Can you rely on the Bible? And you can prove from Bible prophecy that those descendants of Israel are the United States, Britain, and then also a lot of Western European countries like France and others. And we have our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that we'd be very happy to send to you. And that's not to say that those countries are in any way superior. In fact, it puts, you know, it exposes the sin and the evil of those countries, that book does. But instead, this is about a plan that God wants to use to teach all of mankind and to help all of mankind see how much they need him and his truth. And that it's not enough to have wealth, prosperity physically. That's not going to lead even to lasting success, even lasting wealth as a nation. It will all get squandered. It requires God's spirit. It requires God's government. It requires God's truth. And so God is punishing the nations of Israel. And to a certain extent, some of these punishments affect the whole world. And then even there's more punishments coming on the world to bring the whole world to God. But you can see the whole world getting caught up in some of those curses in Leviticus 26 this week with that sense of fear everywhere. Ultimately, though, you know, that fear, those curses, that correction, it's all there to bring the world to God, to bring the world to repentance. And Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, goes through God's plan, what he's doing in world events. And that book is your field manual to understanding world events and God's plan, seeing God behind the news. It's a great place to start to see that. And that book you can get on our website, you can read it online, you can order your own free print copy so that you can go through it with the Bible. Because we're not asking you, hey, just read this book and believe it. We're saying, read this book, prove it from the Bible, turn to the scriptures, see that that this book is just pointing you to and helping you put together different scriptures in the Bible and believe the Bible. And you can get that on our website for free, thetrumpet.com. But to punish Britain, to punish America, God is raising up a European power. And as we ticked over into 2026, we had a couple of pretty significant events coming from the European Union. So on January 1st, Cyprus took over the rotating EU presidency, and they've got a real focus on European security, which means the military, and that's not unique to Cyprus. That's a huge push within Europe right now. But then also Europe's focus on the Middle East. Understandably, Europe is very focused on Russia, and there's a lot of fear of Russia. Latvia, Lithuania, they had a couple of developments building border walls this week. I think Latvia finished a lot of their border fortifications. Lithuania started theirs, and they're making ready to blow up bridges so they can slow down a possible Russian invasion. So there's a lot of fear in Europe, and that is prompting this rearmament. That is prompting Europe to come together and unite, and that's exactly as Herbert W. Armstrong talked about and forecast, based on that same prophetic framework that's in the United States and Britain in prophecy. But Cyprus is also sounding a message of, well, don't forget about the Middle East. And Cyprus is pretty closely involved in the Middle East. You had Hezbollah, for example, threatening Cyprus in the days after October 7th. They feel very threatened by things going on there, and so they're working hard to make sure that Europe directs some of that military buildup towards the Middle East. And that's a key focus of their presidency in the first half of 2026. On December 21st, Cypriot leader. He talked about how the EU needs to be capable of responding swiftly and effectively to crisis situations. So that's an important story to watch. Mr. Flurry wrote about this a couple of times. He had an article in the May-June 2013 Trumpet where he said, "Why should you be concerned about this small island in the Mediterranean?" And then he said, "Cyprus is one of the world's most strategic pieces of property. It will play a significant role in the near future and will probably be the launching pad for World War III." So watch Cyprus's presidency of the European Union. Watch for them to develop as a staging post for Europe to get involved into the Middle East. There's already a lot more going on in terms of militarizing Cyprus. And he has an article, "Why Germany Conquered Cyprus." We can put a link to that in our show notes. You can also go and look back Joshua Michels. He had a great interview with a Cypriot politician that exposed a lot of the militarization that's going on in Cyprus right now. That's about a month old. You could go back and we could put a link to that as well, or you could just go and look through our back catalog. Another significant EU event that kicked in on January 1st is Bulgaria officially became the 21st member of the Eurozone. They dropped their currency, the lev, and they now accept euros. Within Bulgaria itself, that was a pretty controversial development. About 47% oppose using the euro as Bulgaria's only currency. 40% don't want to use the euro at all. Only 25% do approve. There's a lot of Bulgarian citizens that resent the fact that their government didn't hold a referendum about Eurozone membership and adopting this new currency. A Bulgarian store owner said, "Well, economic indicators improve, but the population becomes poorer." And he said more big businesses profit. They see this as something that will make the numbers on paper, will make the GDP go up, but won't lead to much improvement in their own lives. I mean, we'll see. I think I'm no fan of the euro. It has brought a lot of prosperity to southern European countries that have adopted it. It's caused major economic problems as well. I think a lot of that prosperity is more because of subsidies that it bring that you have from Germany and the richer countries that flow to the poorer ones. But there's some downsides for both sides here. By some measures, Bulgaria is the EU's most corrupt country. I think in others, it's behind Hungary. But now you've got Europe's poorest country. They've got an average income of about $20,000 per person. That's about half the average EU income. And they can borrow money with similar ease. We know what happened to Greece when they were brought into the euro and had a lot of debt, didn't have a lot of stability, and it ended up making a financial crisis that would have just been a crisis for Greece, a crisis for the entire eurozone, a crisis for the world. So they've now been brought into the euro. It raises the question, why? Well, political control, I think, is one answer. This helps extend Germany's control over the Balkans. Bulgaria's use of the euro, they extend Germany's financial power southwards towards the Middle East. You know, the headlines in Europe might talk about Russia. The reasons that European politicians give for rearming might be focused on Russia. But there's a lot of senior people in Europe that are very clearly focused on moving towards the Middle East and opening a path there, preparing the way for greater military involvement within the Middle East. And I think you could see Bulgaria's Eurozone membership even in the same kind of context as Cyprus. Now, Bulgaria also does bring the Eurozone closer to Russia as well. It's cementing Europe's eastern and southern frontiers. And now Bulgaria's financial policy is largely controlled by the European Central Bank. And you also have the situation that the Eurozone's founding members and Europe's founding fathers, they weren't opposed to crisis. And in fact, they saw a lot of them. It was very obvious that putting Greece and Germany in the same currency would cause a crisis. I mean, someone said basically if you chose countries at random, you'd do better at having a functioning common currency than the European Union. If you chose it by letters of the alphabet, you'd have a more functioning currency zone than the Eurozone. It was designed to cause a crisis because it was, these people that designed the euro, they want a European federal state. They want a United States of Europe, but voters don't. So what they did is they sold voters and politicians on this idea of a common currency. Look, you still control your own country. You still control your own army, your own government. We're just sharing a currency. And that's going to make it so much easier when you go on holiday. It's going to make trade a lot easier. It's going to take a lot of the uncertainty about exporting and importing. You'll be able to buy things from other European countries easily. We'll create a bigger market. It means we'll have big businesses that can compete with the United States. And they sold them on these economic advantages. However, having this currency zone without a political government, it causes crises because you have countries pulling in different directions. You have Greece spending like crazy on the European credit card while Germany tries to be frugal. And then when that blows up, you have German politicians upset about, well, we don't want to bail out Greece. Why are we sending our pensioners' money over to Greece? The Greeks are like, well, why are the Germans telling us what to do? You can kind of understand both positions. And it's because this common currency is designed to keep creating crises. So you do wonder whether inviting someone like Bulgaria into that, is that designed to continue the crisis? Is that designed to help speed things up, help lead to another Eurozone crisis that can lead to more push towards a United States of Europe? I mean, if you look at what it says in Revelation chapter 17, it talks about a union of 10 nations. This is the united power God is raising up to correct modern Israel. 10 nations or groups of nations. Daniel 2 talks about this as well. We have 21 nations in the Eurozone. That it's going to shrink down somehow. That implies a pretty big crisis. It's not the only way that it could happen, I guess, but that's certain. You've got some massive changes ahead. It talks about there being 10 kings, not presidents, not 10 committees, not 10 parliaments, 10 kings. And so the indication of Bible prophecy and what Herbert W. Armstrong talks about, it seems like you're going to have a big economic crisis, probably caused by what's going on in America and the epic borrowing there. And then it's made worse by the Eurozone and it all blows up. And it's quite a dramatic moment for Europe, a moment probably of real suffering. And then you have 10 kings come along and pick up the pieces. And we've got to push aside government. We've got to get strong men to deal with the emergency. And you have this Holy Roman Empire rise up. I mean, in many, many ways, the Holy Roman Empire is already here. The Atlantic is talking about the German war machine. We're just talking about some of the last few changes. So watch what happens there with the Eurozone now that Bulgaria has joined. That's another important story. And watch for the rise of that Holy Roman Empire to continue. Well, those are the major stories from Europe as we go into the new year. We're going to do a bit of a different format today. We've got some meetings and things going on internally here, so we've got a little bit of a different schedule. Instead of doing our standard interview format, each of our panelists has recorded their own segment, and we will go and listen to those now. And first up, we'll get an update from Mihailo Zekic on what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on with the protests in Iran, and another very important story in Iran that hasn't gotten the same kind of massive media attention that these protests have.
Iran has been rocked by the largest protests the country has seen in about 3 years. These protests started Monday. We don't have an accurate number count, but they're flooding the streets of Tehran and many, many other places in Iran. The primary cause of these protests is Iran's economic insecurity. Since the war with Israel and the U.S. in June, the currency there has had an inflationary spiral out of control. There's been other problems in Iran, like water shortages. The merchant class in Iran is reportedly leading these protests, complaining about how they can't do business in the country, and they're venting their frustrations at the regime, at Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And they're, of course, joined by students. They're usually quick to jump to any excuse to protest the regime. The regime has responded with live fire, firing rounds of ammunition, killing people in the protest movement. But reportedly, there are members of the security forces that have refused to comply. There's also reports of places like police stations being stormed, of at least one member of the Basij, one of these security organizations, being killed by the protesters, and even Khamenei reportedly fleeing Tehran. This is what Israeli analyst Melanie Phillips had to say about these protests. Quote, "These demonstrations have been far more consequential than previous such revolts. They started among the businessmen of the bazaars, the same kind of people who had helped depose the Shah and brought the Islamic revolutionary regime to power in 1979. Further down, maybe this revolt will fizzle out under ferocious reprisals, as all previous ones have done, but maybe this time it will succeed in toppling the regime. It's the closest the people have ever come to doing so. If they succeed, this would have a seismic impact far beyond Iran. It would transform and reshape global politics immeasurably for the better by removing a malevolent force. End quote. So there are plenty of people looking at all these circumstances and thinking, maybe this time the people have a shot. Maybe this time we could see a democratic revolution and in Iran. One of those people is United States President Donald Trump. He posted on True Social, quote, "If Iran shoots and violently kills peaceful protesters, which is their custom, the United States of America will come to their rescue. We are locked and loaded and ready to go," end quote. Now, President Trump campaigned on removing America from foreign entanglements, especially in the Middle East, but Iran has been one of the big exceptions to that. As I mentioned earlier, he went to war with Iran and bombed its nuclear sites. How exactly will he respond? I mean, Iran has already shot at protesters. His red line has been crossed. So we'll have to wait and see. But there's a lot of turmoil happening right now in Iran. A lot of people expect change. The regime is acting in ways that normally doesn't act, even reportedly, again, the leader fleeing the capital. What is going to happen next? What does a wounded animal do when it's cornered? Well, Iran right now is the wounded animal, and it is taking more and more desperate measures, and we had a glimpse of just how desperate those are with a report on Sunday. We talked last week on this program about Iran giving the green light for its nuclear weapons program. But it's apparently not just nuclear weapons. This is what Iran International wrote in an article on December 29th. Quote, "Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, is developing biological and chemical warheads for the country's long-range ballistic missiles," informed military sources told Iran International on Sunday. Further down, the sources, who requested anonymity due to the sensitivity of the matter, said these activities have accelerated in recent months and are being pursued amid rising regional tensions and Tehran's concerns about the possibility of another direct confrontation with Israel and the United States. One source told Iran International, "The Iranian leadership views potential Israeli and American attacks as a threat to its very existence and intends, in the event of a conflict, to significantly raise the cost for the opposing side," end quote. In other words, it's the same point we made last week. They saw how vulnerable they were in June. They saw how America and Israel are intent on going to war if they so choose. And we just heard President Trump's comments saying, I did it before, I could do it again. And not only do they feel like they need to defend themselves, they're saying, we intend on literally going the nuclear option or the biological option or the chemical option. We are intent on creating the worst attack since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And again, this news just broke out now, but apparently this has been going on for months. How far along are they? Probably a lot more than most people expect. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian, he basically runs the day-to-day operations of the government under the supreme leader. He said on Saturday, quote, "In my opinion, we are at total war with the United States, Israel, and Europe," end quote. They already think they're at war, and they're bringing Europe into this as well. We'll talk about that soon. Another point I think is interesting. Iran has already had access to chemical weapons for years. Syria, under Bashar al-Assad, the previous president, he famously had his chemical weapons program that he used to gas his own people. He was a proxy of Iran. He's obviously been out for about a year now. The new government there isn't that friendly to Iran, but Syria has a porous border. The government hasn't established control over all areas. Who's to say some of those chemical weapons haven't been brought back to Iran for safekeeping? Who's to say even when Assad was still in power, Iran may have seen the writing on the wall and took some back home just in case? There's so many unknowns with this, but when you're talking about weapons of mass destruction, from a country that openly says they want it, from a country that has a radical Islamist ideology bent on perpetual war with everybody that's not them, and more than just the context of these messages, you have to bring in the focus of Bible prophecy, as we always do on this show, and the same prophecy we went to last week applies today. Daniel 11, verse 40, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." You keep reading to Daniel 12, verse 1, it's the same vision, same flow, and it talks about a crisis so bad that it would be unprecedented in human history. And as we talked about on last week's program, this is talking about war between Europe, or the king of the north, and Iran, or the king of the south, and its proxies. But I want to focus today on that word, push. There's a lot more in that word than the English suggests. This is what Gesenius' Hebrew called the lexicon says of that word, quote, "To strike with the horns, used of horned animals, used figuratively of a victor who prostrates the nations before him." Elsewhere, the King James Bible renders that same word in the Hebrew as gore. So this is a violent, provocative word. This is talking about the spark that could start a major war, a transcontinental war. Doesn't that sound like, if Iran were to get nuclear weapons, biological weapons, chemical weapons, doesn't that sound like that could be a part of this push, or at least be on people's minds as all of this is coming together? This is what Trump editor-in-chief Mr. Gerald Fleury wrote in his book, The King of the South. We can put a link on the show notes so you could order a free copy. Quote, "Iran is extremely radical, the king over radical Islam. Where is this nation's pushiness leading? To war, just as it has in the past. It is leading inevitably to terrifying war with weapons of mass destruction. It could lead nowhere else. Iran is preparing itself to trigger a nuclear World War III. Further down, no words will stop this king of terror. The Iranian leader believes that causing a nuclear cataclysm will hasten the coming of his Messiah. No matter what happens, these religious zealots believe they are winners. No other nuclear power thinks like that. It makes nuclear war inevitable." So in a nutshell, if you take anything away from this segment, it is keep your eyes on Iran and keep your eyes on its development on weapons of mass destruction. This is critical for global security. Tying it in with these protests, this is why people want these protests to succeed, but based on Bible prophecy, we can assume no matter what changes happen as a result, if there are any, Iran is still going to stay in power as the king of the south, as the king over radical Islam, as an Islamist government bent on perpetual war with the rest, and it's even going to get stronger. It's going to be king. It is going to be the one to gore Europe, gore the world, like a bull goring a man. So Iran is not going to turn into a freedom-loving friend of the West, however this turns out. Expect Iran to grow in strength, and expect Iran to, again, just cement itself as this king of the South power. But Iran's obviously not the only country experiencing great events in the Middle East. One other story, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited President Trump at Mar-a-Lago, his residence in Florida, on Monday. You see lots of praise between the two leaders. They both called each other friends. Netanyahu and his wife were the only leaders invited to President Trump's New Year's celebrations. But that doesn't mean that everything was rosy with the meeting. They went there to talk about the Gaza ceasefire. Looks like that is going along as smoothly as could be between the two leaders that we know of, but according to sources speaking with Axios, one major sticking point was with Israeli policies in the West Bank. Now, Hamas isn't just in Gaza. It's in the West Bank. It's in other places. And they're still fighting Israel there. Half of the West Bank, you look at places like Jenin, Nablus, these cities in the West Bank, they are basically anarchic terrorist communes where Hamas and other groups can establish governance, plan attacks, carry out attacks. You can't blame Israel for doing security operations there, and they have been increasing security operations in there, even as there is a ceasefire in Gaza. But according to a U.S. source and another source with direct knowledge, Axios's words, quote, "The president and his team raised settler violence against Palestinian civilians, the financial instability of the Palestinian Authority, and Israeli settlement expansion. Further down, the U.S. message was that changing course in the West Bank is critical to repairing Israel's relations with European countries and hopefully expand the Abraham Accords." Bit of euphemisms over there. What they're really saying is, Israel, we don't want you expanding your military operations in the West Bank. We don't want you building more settlements. The settler violence in the West Bank, I mean, those are not to justify hooliganism or anything like that, but compared to what the terror groups are actually planning, those are minor, those are disproportionate. A lot of times they're fabricated. We talked before in this program about how months ago they were claiming settlers set fire to a Christian church in the West Bank, and it was really a grass fire in an archaeological site that Israelis were trying to put out. But Israel, it doesn't matter what they do, regardless on whether you think Israel should be in the West Bank, they are in the West Bank. They have interests there, and it's complicated whether they want to stay or pull out. They have to, it's a big security liability for Israel one way or another. They have to do operations there. And anytime they do anything, immediately the international community, including the United States, nope, you can't do that. Stand down, give the Palestinians space. They mentioned the Palestinian Authority, the leader there, Mahmoud Abbas. We've talked about this before, that he's no angel. He's done a lot to attack Israel in, like, since he's been in power. You can't blame Israel for not wanting to work with him, but according to the U.S., no, you need to keep this going. And that goes to another prophecy in Zechariah 14, verses 1 to 2, which speaks of half of Jerusalem falling into captivity in the context of this greater crisis that includes the King of the South, that includes all these other conflicts we've been mentioning. And Mr. Fleury has said that this implies a Palestinian takeover of Eastern Jerusalem, which implies that the side where they control next to Jerusalem, the West Bank, they're going to get more organized there. They're going to get more ambitious there. They're going to be able to take Israel's capital away from it. And America telling Israel to stand down in the West Bank certainly plays into that.
The big story for the Asia region is that Russia's war on Ukraine rages on despite peace efforts. And this has been a disappointing week in some ways, because if we think back to Sunday, there was quite a lot of optimism in the air. And it seemed that a peace deal was finally materializing for this horrendous war that has killed so many hundreds of thousands of people. So Sunday, that's when Russian President Vladimir Putin held a phone call with U.S. President Donald Trump, and President Trump said that that call was, quote, good and productive. And then 2 hours after the call, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited President Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And Zelensky agreed during that visit to give in to Russia on several points of a peace deal, apparently points that Putin had mentioned during that phone call a couple of hours earlier. And during that visit, President Trump also agreed to travel to Ukraine to petition Parliament about surrendering some of Ukrainian territory to Russia. That, you know, a surrender of that kind would require formal changes to Ukrainian law, including their constitution. So Trump was preparing to go there and convince lawmakers to make the necessary amendments. So optimism was very much in the air. And President Trump said at the time, he said, quote, the war's end is closer than ever. But then, amid all of that optimism, Ukraine went and launched 91 drones, not at military targets, but at Putin's residence in Novgorod. This was an apparent attempt to assassinate Vladimir Putin, and as a result of that drone strike, the Russians came out and said that they needed to reevaluate and they needed to be more rigid in the negotiations. So the deal was off, and all those hopes for peace were dashed. At least that's the way the Russians told the story. But on Wednesday, the CIA confirmed really what Russia watchers understood from the start, and that is that this so-called Ukrainian drone attack never happened. Ukraine had, you know, vehemently denied this from the very start, and Russia couldn't produce a single shred of evidence proving it, unless you count a comically bad AI fabrication of video that they created. The video that was circulated had a tiny little drone firing what appeared to be a Hellfire missile, you know, missiles that were impossible for a drone of that size to carry. The video also showed a car driving through disappearing walls of a fountain. It even had English text on what was supposed to be a Russian security camera. It was very obviously AI slop. And that's all the Russians could come up with to prove that this attack happened. So CIA Director John Ratcliffe analyzed the claims. He analyzed the lack of evidence, he and his team, and they confirmed that this attack never happened. So it was clear that this was yet another instance of Vladimir Putin feigning engagement with peace efforts while manufacturing a pretext to reject them and to keep on killing. I think we've been through four or five iterations of this cycle now, and it just keeps on going essentially the same way. And the underlying problem here is explained by something that Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry covered in our April 2025 issue. He explained that President Trump has major flaws in his thinking about how to bring about peace. And one part of his article from this issue, it says Trump has, quote, a serious blind spot when it comes to peace negotiation and international diplomacy. And then it says that this is a, quote, deadly weakness. Mr. Flurry explains that the foundation of this weakness is President Trump thinking that appeasement will work for a man like Putin, and thinking that Russia really doesn't have to be held accountable for its brutal war crimes in this war. And Mr. Flurry discusses a Bible passage. It's Isaiah 33, verse 7, which says, the ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. He says that this weeping is because we have proved that we do not know the way of peace. Only God does. So this article is a powerful one, explaining a great deal about why these peace efforts keep on failing. And if anyone would like to check that article out, it's called Does Donald Trump Know the Way to Peace? And then I also wanted to mention a smaller story here about Chinese General Secretary Xi Jinping. He rang in the new year by giving a speech vowing to bring Taiwan under control of the Chinese Communist Party. This, of course, is nothing new for Xi Jinping. He has long pledged to conquer Taiwan, but there is kind of a growing relevance around these threats because this speech came just hours after China had concluded its Justice Mission 2025 military drills at locations around Taiwan. During those drills, we saw Chinese forces operating closer to the island than in any previous exercises. And then this speech also follows a Pentagon report published a couple of weeks ago saying that China will have the military capacity to capture Taiwan by the end of next year, 2027. So that's a sobering assessment. And Xi Jinping's speech made clear that part of the reason why he's feeling increasingly emboldened to make his move on Taiwan is because of the gains made by his ally, Vladimir Putin, against Ukraine, and by the decision of the United States and Europe not to halt Putin's imperialism there. Now, President Xi didn't say this directly, but he did say, quote, the reunification of our motherland, a trend of the times, is unstoppable. Now, reunification there is an inaccurate word since the Chinese Communist Party has never controlled Taiwan. But nevertheless, he says that seizing smaller nations' territory has become a trend of modern times. No one stopped it when Putin did it, and now it's his turn. And the Trumpet has long said that due to America's weak will, the Chinese Communist Party will eventually make good on its pledge to seize Taiwan. And then I wanted to mention one final story here about North Korea. They may have just joined a very exclusive group of nations that operate nuclear-powered submarines. So North Korea has just published footage of their leader, Kim Jong-un, inspecting what they claim is the nation's first nuclear-powered submarine. And if these claims are accurate, it would mean that North Korea now poses a more dangerous strategic threat. And that's because nuclear submarines can sustain higher speeds for longer periods than diesel electric models. They're also far quieter and extremely difficult to detect, and they can stay submerged for months. And most importantly, they can launch nuclear missiles from hidden locations. That's the most important capability for nuclear deterrence and for counterstrikes and surprise attacks as well. So this could be quite an advance for North Korea. Right now, only China, France, India, Russia, the US, and the UK are known to operate nuclear-powered subs. So this would make North Korea a member of quite an exclusive club. And when we consider that Russia and China have shared all kinds of very advanced military technology with North Korea, including nuclear weapons technology, then I think that these claims very well could be accurate.
So the 2025 calendar year has now officially come to an end. We're approaching the one-year anniversary of United States President Donald Trump's second term in office. And one of the biggest pieces of economic news that's unfolded over the course of the past year is President Trump's tariffs. President Trump came into office in the United States promising to make America a more independent, self-sufficient country that's not reliant on foreign imports. Back in April, when he first announced his first big round of tariffs, he called it Liberation Day, claiming that America will be liberated from dependency on the rest of the world. And now we're finally getting the data pouring in to see if his strategy's working. And as with most economic strategies, there's definitely pros and cons to his approach. The United States has collected about $195 billion in tariffs this year. So that's about 153% increase from the year before. So more than double the tariff revenues we collected during the last year of the Biden administration. Now, the U.S. trade deficit is actually up 17% this year. That may initially seem like a weird statistic. It's like tariffs are supposed to make the trade deficit go down. The main reason it's up so much is that many American companies for the first half this year really stocked up on foreign goods in anticipation of the tariffs. So the threat of the tariffs caused American companies to basically buy more foreign goods than they normally would in order to keep those in storage for future use. Now that the tariffs have kind of settled in, though, our September numbers shows that actually the U.S. trade deficit for September, the closest month we have data for, has actually fallen to its lowest level since 2020 when the COVID pandemic began, basically causing many economic analysts to admit that Donald Trump's tariffs are doing what he wants them to. They're raising revenue for the U.S. government, and when you adjust for the fact that companies stockpiled goods at the first part of the year, they are now buying less foreign goods as they get more expensive. So if this trend continues and these September numbers keep trending down over time, Donald Trump's tariffs will have worked like he wanted them to, reducing American dependence on foreign goods. Now, I said at the beginning that there's pros and cons to this strategy, and that the fact that America is less dependent on foreign nations is good for U.S. national security. That's a big plus. However, if anyone thinking that these tariffs, though, that were actually going to hurt America's competitors like China, however, are in for a big disappointment, and that actually China ran a $1 trillion trade surplus this year. Part of that might have been U.S. companies stockpiling Chinese goods, although a small part of it. The main reason China's running such a trade surplus is that it's reorienting its more trade to Europe and to Africa and to Latin America and to Southeast Asia and other places that are not America. So as the trade between the U.S. and China decreases, China's looking for other trade partners to fill that goal. So basically, Donald Trump's goal is to make the United States a self-reliant fortress America, where China has a very different goal. They're looking to emerge as like this communist empire that's leading a trade bloc of developing nations around the world. And this is very prophetic. In Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flory's book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, he focuses in on prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 specifically about China and Europe leading a mart of nations to besiege the United States. So for many years, the U.S. and China have been, their economies have been so intertwined that people even call the two economies together Chimerica. It's a kind of a funny wordplay off the Chimera, as an ancient Greek monster that had the body parts of different animals. So it's like you've got the body parts of America and the body parts of China forming one monstrous economy. And so now Trump's tariffs are causing economists like Niall Ferguson to talk about the end of Chimerica, or basically the end of this close trade relationship between the U.S. and China, as the U.S. works to become more self-sufficient and China reaches out to Europe and the developing world to develop a trade empire. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, also wrote an article we'll put in the show notes a few years ago now, titled Where the America-China Clash is Leading, that specifically specifies that this economic divorce, if you want to call it that, between the U.S. and China was prophesied because for a mart of nations to emerge as a force of opposition against the United States, the mart of nations cannot be overly reliant on the United States. For years, people have said, it's like, oh, China could never, like, try to besiege the United States economically because doing so would hurt China more than it hurts the U.S. That calculus is changing now as this trade war is kind of slowly weaning the U.S. and China off of reliance on each other in a way that's going to make it more possible for these powers to be more antagonistic to each other. And of course, none of this is to say that Donald Trump was wrong to put tariffs on China. The Chinese Communist Party's done reprehensible things, and you can make a strong moral case that we shouldn't be trading with China. And yet, the Bible prophesies that because of America's other sins, this mart of nations is going to be one of God's tools to weaken the United States, as you get a giant trade war between the United States and this emerging trade empire China's building. And so 2025, just looking at China's huge trade surplus and declining trade between the United States and China was a big development in the overall development of this long-term prophecy. There was some other news in the United States, though. Zohran Mamdani, the New York City mayor, who's gaining many headlines for being the first openly Muslim mayor of New York and the second openly socialist mayor of New York, was sworn in on New Year's Day, sworn into office. He won the election a couple months ago, being the first New York City mayor to actually take his oath of office on the Quran instead of the Bible. And the America's First Amendment rights to religious freedom give him that right. However, this still points to a major societal change in America, where in the past 20 years, we've gone from having 78% of U.S. adults being Christians to only 60% of U.S. adults being Christian. And amongst the younger generation, that's down to only about 45% Christian, less than half Christian, showing that really some of these just cultural opposition to atheism and agnosticism and these other spiritual traditions like Islam is waning as America moves into a phase where many cities like New York are what you consider a post-Christian society. Other news highlighting just some of the curses of multiculturalism and this changing culture in America is the big expose that the Somali community in Minnesota has been running a lot of Somali-run daycares that aren't actually daycares, but are really just front companies for money laundering and a bunch of other financial corruption. So big scandal there, just looking at how this this immigrant community in Minnesota, an Islamic community, is really using these daycares as a front to steal money from people in the United States, just highlighting another financial curse on America. And then another story, this one from Canada. We try not to forget the other English-speaking nations in our Anglo-America section too much, showing another curse in Canada on just really what the bad fruits of this multicultural experiment, where you had a black man, a former football player in Nova Scotia, raped two women, was justly arrested and sentenced to prison for this crime, but was only sentenced to 2 years in jail because of a Trudeau-era initiative instructing judges to consider people's racial background in sentencing. And so they said that, well, because he was black and he was under a lot of stress and he didn't have culturally appropriate support systems, whatever that means, they're going to give him a lesser sentence than they would have given him if he were a white man committing these same rapes. And so one of the foundations of the Western legal system is the Bible. Then the Bible famously saying that there should be one law for you and the stranger that dwells within your gate, saying like one law for everyone in the country, regardless of their ethnic background. We see that the Canada and the Western world's turning their back on this legal principle, giving lighter sentences to ethnic minorities, precisely just because they're ethnic minorities and you don't want to punish them for rape the same as you'd punish someone else. And so that's just really one final curse we'll highlight from the Anglo-American region here on Trumpet World this week.
Well, thank you very much to all of our panelists who contributed their segments today. You can get all of the literature that was mentioned on our website, thetrumpet.com. If you click on the literature tab, or we'll have links in the show notes, you can get all of those. I'd really encourage, again, I'd emphasize the United States and Britain in Prophecy as a fantastic starting point. And again, you can get that on our website. You can read it online. You can order your own free print copy for you to go through and study alongside your Bible. And again, I'd really encourage you to do that, to dig into that, to use that book to dig into your Bible. And it will show you how to apply, or how these Bible scriptures apply to world events that are going on around you, and really bring your Bible to life and show you how powerful, how up to date the Bible is. And then that can help you appreciate the Bible more in terms of what it has to say about your life and how to live your life and changes you and I need to be making. So again, you can get that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you as well to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production. Thank you to you, the viewer, for joining us. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'll be back with our regular shows next week. And until then, keep watching your world.